Hello, everyone. Happy Ontario Jewish Heritage Month, month of May. Good evening. I'm Judy Kasman, the newly elected president of our society, and I'd like to welcome you all here this evening, our members and guests and some DNA relatives that I've found here, too. I'd like to introduce, well, actually,
the mic isn't working well?
So, just to let you know that if you pay $5 admission this evening and you choose to join as a member, your admission will be applied to your membership. Rates are $40 a year with a spousal unit at $50. This is also a reminder for those of you who have not yet paid your dues for 2018 to do so right away, either here in person or online, to ensure that you get the next issue of Shem Tov and that you can participate in our special interest groups. It's not often that we import a speaker all the way from England, so tonight is a special occasion. And before we start our featured talk, I'd like to mention a few upcoming events. Our next program, Brick Walls and Breakthroughs, will take place here at Sher Shemayim on Wednesday evening, June the 13th. And unfortunately, due to circumstances beyond our control, the MyHeritage program that was scheduled for June 4th has been canceled. We have four special interest group meetings coming up in June. Litvak on Thursday the 7th of June, DNA on the 14th, Thursday the 14th, and Ukraine on Thursday the 21st, and all of those are held at the Family History Center. And the Central Europe SIG will be held here on Monday, June 25th. And don't forget our pre-summer program, Brick Walls and Breakthroughs, here on Wednesday, June 13th. Flyers are at the table, featuring stories of discovery by Les Kelman, Merle Langbord-Levine, and Neil Richler. Many thanks to our programming committee for arranging this event and to our volunteers at the Welcome Desk and to those responsible for providing us with refreshments. I'd also like to mention that there's a possibility of a gathering prior to the IAJGS conference in Poland this August for those in our society who will be attending, so stay tuned for details. So, now I'd like to call on Les Kelman to introduce Lisa Cooper, our speaker for this evening.
Hey, good evening and welcome. And no need to panic, I'm not going to ask you to move. We've got all the seats the way we want them, and that's the way they'll remain. So it's my pleasure tonight to welcome Lisa Porter, who's going to talk about a forgotten land and describe what life was like over there in the shtetl, in the villages, in the towns. And it's interesting because about 2 years ago when we did a survey of our membership about what they would like to see as part of our programming, the overwhelming response was how-to sessions, how to find birth, marriage, death records, how to find naturalization records, how to find census records. And I would exaggerate if I said we had an obsession with records, but certainly there was a clear interest. And I thought about it, why would that be? And the reason is if you look at genealogy and family tree, there's probably three components. There's records, there's photographs, and there's stories. And we all know that the records are available. Certainly UK, USA, Australia, Canada, there's plenty of records. And even now from Eastern Europe, there's more records available than anyone would ever have imagined. Where we tend to fall short is photographs, unless we're lucky and we have collections. And the worst part is probably stories, because when we should have asked, we didn't ask. And by the time we got around to realizing we should be asking, there was no one around to ask. So when you get almost as far as you can go with the records, you start to think about what stories can I write. And I know from my personal experience, I did a partial write-up of my family leaving Ukraine and going to Glasgow in Scotland. And I managed to complete the story. It was based on, and being kind, about 40% fact and maybe 60% imagination. And what I'm really looking forward to tonight is, I think what Lisa's going to give us is a wealth of information that we can use to complete our stories, as I say, partially based on fact, partially based on the types of information we're going to get tonight, and our never forgotten imagination. So with that, I'd like to welcome Lisa.
Thank you very much. Firstly, can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
Just if I get too far away from the mic, please just at the back wave your hands and I'll come closer in. But I do tend to move around a bit quite when I'm talking. But I mean, I think thank you, Les, for that introduction. And I think you're absolutely right. Most of us don't have these family stories. I'm lucky in two ways, in two respects, for being able to pass on these stories. In a way that's, I'm sure, not entirely unique. I'm sure there are plenty of other people who have something similar, but most people don't. And the two ways that I'm lucky are, firstly, that my grandmother was a great storyteller. She loved telling these stories, and her niece is sitting there nodding. And so my father and my aunt grew up in Canada, they grew up in Winnipeg, but they grew up surrounded by these stories of shtetl life, and she loved repeating these stories. My father, once he moved to the UK, he became a historian and worked as a historian at the University of East Anglia in England. And he wanted to revisit these stories from his childhood as a historian, as an academic. And so when my grandmother was an old lady in the 1970s, he went back on his family visits when she was getting ill. He just wanted to record these stories before they got lost. So he took a stack of old audio cassettes and an old tape recorder, and asked her questions and recorded these stories. And they were all recorded in Yiddish, which is a language I don't speak. I'll talk a little bit more about that at the end. But those two reasons, I'm lucky that first that my grandmother was a storyteller, second that my dad had the foresight to get these stories down and record it. And I guess that I then asked my dad to sit down and translate them for me so I could then share them with you. So this book is my grandmother's story. I've lost my pointer. This is her in the middle. I'm going to grab my pointer back. So this girl in the middle is Pearl. She's my grandmother. She was born around the turn of the last century in a shtetl called Pavelich, which is about 100 kilometres southwest of Kiev. So this picture, I think, was taken around 1914, probably just before the start of the First World War. And her father, who's the man next to her, he died not too long afterwards. So tonight I'm going to talk about some of the historical events that my grandmother lived through and the effect they had on my family and on other families. You're nodding away, you know, other families like ours. I'm going to read some extracts from the book. My grandmother lived through an incredibly dramatic period of 20th century history in Russia. But my story, it touches on this, but it's a story about ordinary people trying to lead ordinary lives, but in extraordinary times. And if your families came from the Ukraine or other parts of the Russian Empire, then this is going to be your story too. These events relate to how my family coped with the events, but they would have all, everybody in the Pale of Settlement, the area where the Jews were restricted to living, they would have lived through very similar things and gone through similar experiences. So my grandmother's name was Pearl, and she was born in Pavelich, and grew up speaking Yiddish, intermingled also with spatterings of Polish and Ukrainian and Russian. Because the town, like many of these little shtetl towns, they were a melting pot of different cultures, different religions, different nationalities. And on her mother's side, the family were prosperous grain dealers, and on her father's side, this is her father here, they were religious scholars, and they were penniless, but being scholars, they were very, very well respected in the community. So Pearl's mother died when she was six. If I could work out how to move the photo on and it's not happening. Where's my arrow? There it is, it's right over there. There we go. So, this is her mother, Etilea. This is Pearl. This is Nathan Unico as a baby, and their older sister Sarah. So Pearl's mother died when she was quite young. They had another daughter after this, and she died not long afterwards. And then Pearl was brought up by her grandparents, Belle and Pessy, in a large house that also served as a warehouse for her grandfather's grain business. My grandmother was the second of four children, and in the same house as them also lived two cousins who were also orphaned quite young. Now, their grandmother, Pessy, this was the lady who controlled the household. And she, as many of you probably know all about the evil eye, she was very superstitious, as ladies of her time were, and she was petrified of the evil eye. So, and she was terrified of having her photo taken because she thought it would cast an evil eye on her. And I'm very pleased that later in life, I think she must have thought, I'm old now, what can happen to me? And so thankfully we're able to see what she looks like. And one thing I'd like to say about this picture is you see before you a very old lady. She looks pretty ancient here. And we go looking at our family tree and looking at the dates. She died when she was about 65. So she would be in her early 60s in this picture, and that's just testament to the difficult life that people led in those days. So before Pearl was born, and in particular in the period of 1881 to 1905, the Pale of Settlement saw terrible violence against the Jews, the pogroms that I'm sure you all know about and would be the reason for a lot of your families moving, emigrating to Canada. And these pogroms were certainly tolerated and often encouraged by the Tsar and the ruling elite of Russia. I'm going to start with a reading from 1881, from that period. "That'll serve the man right," were Grandfather's first words. This is Pearl speaking. Grandfather's first words when he heard of the explosion that had killed Tsar Alexander II. Although the Tsar had achieved a reputation as a great reformer for freeing the serfs, Beryl would grumble that he hadn't done so much to emancipate the Jews. It was true that our people gained some limited freedoms under his rule. Forced conscription of children was halted, more Jews were able to attend Russian schools and universities. But emancipation, this most definitely was not. My grandfather was soon eating his words, however, for the events that ensued rocked the lives not just of my family, but of every single Jew right across the Pale. After the Tsar's assassination, rumours began to spread. To begin with, the Jews weren't aware of the gossip and whispering. It took place surreptitiously, inside houses in the Christian parts of towns. But then it spread to the shops, the markets, the train stations. The rumours were everywhere. It was Jewish revolutionaries that had killed the Tsar, and it was time for revenge. Inebriated mobs pulled down market stalls, smashed shop windows and kicked in doors in towns and cities across the Pale. Velvet dresses and woolen shawls, picture frames and broken chair legs, cabbages and bottled plums, all were trampled underfoot or piled up in grotesque mountains of mud. And everywhere there were screaming, running feet, fearful faces trying to stay out of sight. A snowstorm of white feathers cascaded out of windows and hovered in the air, having been ripped from the confines of mattresses and pillows. Some of the rioters dressed themselves up in new outfits stolen from the ready-made clothes stores, piling one layer over another, shirts over jackets and underwear over trousers, until they looked like characters in some absurd stage play. How to count the cost? How many honest traders and merchants were bankrupted? How many families bereft of all they had spent their whole lives working towards? How many children so traumatised that they would forever relive the fear in their dreams? So that was experience of the pogroms. These waves of violence against the Jews continued regularly. 1881 was the big starting point with the assassination of Tsar Alexander II. The pogroms persisted, died down a bit, and then really came back again in 1905, which was the year that the first major signs of revolution were seen in Russia. The Russian Revolution, as we know it, was 1917, but 12 years earlier, in 1905, there were rebellions, uprisings. Lots of Jews joined in the marching and the demonstrations as a way of protesting about the discrimination that they affected them under the Tsars and affected them in their daily lives. There were quotas for Jewish children able to go to Russian schools, quotas for university. They were restricted to living in the Pale. They weren't allowed to own land, and so on and so on. I'm sure you know some of it. So once again, in 1905, the fact that Jews were heavily involved in the demonstrations and in the revolutions that were going on, again caused an anti-Semitic backlash, and this time was even more bloody than in 1881. As well as raiding Jewish shops and businesses, the so-called Black Hundreds, these were the Tsar's vigilante groups, they killed Jews in their own homes, they hacked people to death in the streets. And it was, I was reading historical accounts of it, absolutely horrific. And most of the violence was restricted to major towns and cities. So small towns like Pavlich, they were generally spared, but people still lived in fear of what they heard. People had relatives, news travels quickly in terrible times. Everybody knew what was going on, but people just tried to carry on and live a normal life through this. So I've got a couple of readings about what life was like in my grandmother's childhood. The first is about her talking about her daily life, her day-to-day life as a child. So I had few cares as a young child. Just as my mother had been cosseted in her youth, my sister and I were brought up like the daughters of a princess. Our mother shunned the local tailor, and instead we travelled to the town of Berdichev to visit the dressmaker, who made us fashionable outfits fringed with velvet and lace. I loved these visits to the city. I was always enthralled by the clamour of the market traders and the horse-drawn streetcars that clattered along the cobblestones. And then there was the excitement of collecting our new clothes. We believed that we would be the best-dressed girls in all of Pavlich. Like our mother before us, we girls were never taught to sew or darn or cook. Baba was responsible for looking after the needs of the entire household, as well as helping Zayda, grandfather, by collecting the takings of his warehouse and keeping his books up to date. So, a tiny, energetic woman whose life's sorrow was reflected in her eyes, well, she was the linchpin of the family. And her life's sorrow was that she brought into the world no fewer than 13 children, and only two of them survived into adulthood. And even they both died young, leaving these six orphan children that the grandparents looked after. The Baba never let a single second go to waste. Every morning she would rise at daybreak to milk her cow, light the fires, then set to work on the kitchen floor, scrubbing the flagstones until they sparkled. As her children and grandchildren washed and dressed, she prepared the table for breakfast. The kitchen was Baba's domain, and she ruled it strictly and efficiently as Zayda ran his warehouse. In any quiet moment, she was always to be found there, knitting needles clicking, a ball of wool trailing across the floor as she engaged in the never-ending task of knitting and darning the family's socks and stockings. Every afternoon was spent chopping, boiling, frying, and best of all, pastry making. As befits the wife of a successful grain merchant, Baba too had a special relationship with wheat. The fine milled flour it produced came alive as she caressed it in her gnarled hands. She could make a ball of pastry dance, stretching the dough over both knobbly fists, pulling and turning it in the air like a magician with a wand, creating paper-thin sheets that were an even thickness from one side to the other without recourse to a rolling pin. For me, seeing Bubba at work was as mesmerised as watching conjuring tricks. And later as a child, I remember my grandmother coming to our house in the UK and making dough to make her knishes and blintzes that was such unfamiliar foods to us in the UK. And she would do this thing with just doing this. Later in life, I was travelling in China. I saw people making noodles the same way by hand. And she just had this amazing way of producing producing fine pastry somehow with her hands. The next reading is an insight into Zaid as well. So Baba Pessy's husband, who was a grain dealer, and it tells how people did business in those days. And sadly, we don't have any photos of Zaga. And I believe that he probably would have thought it a bit frivolous taking photographs, and he would have kind of sniffed and poo-pooed at the whole thing. International commerce, in an era before telephones and without established rates of exchange, was a complex and time-consuming affair. Every day, Zaida's driver waited with a coach and horse to take him to the train station at Popilna, a small town about 12 miles from Pavlich, where he would await news from each train that passed of the prices currently being paid for different products further up or down the line, market rates in Kiev and export prices in Odessa, the region's major port. The railway station was a daunting place for outsiders. When I was little, again, this is my grandmother speaking, I occasionally travelled to visit relatives by train with my parents. I remember dodging between the swarms of traders from all over the area who congregated to discuss prices and close deals with travelling businessmen. My father would scoop me up in his arms so I didn't get lost or trampled, and the noise was so loud, with frenzied shouts and hand gestures from all sides, that I couldn't understand how anyone was able to follow what was going on. As I grew older, my grandfather tried to explain it to me. The station was like a stock exchange, he said. The market prices went up and down, depending on the time of year or how bountiful the last harvest was, and not just locally, but all around the world. Even day by day, the price of grain would fluctuate. A good deal of the trade was conducted by a process of barter, so that a sack of sugar beet might be worth two sacks of rye one day, but could, theoretically at least, change hands for one sack or three the next. Zeta also passed hours drinking tea with his fellow traders, discussing prices and agreeing complicated speculative contracts based on the potential production of various grain producers months or even years ahead. He even put his signature to sophisticated deals that had allowed him the option to buy or sell shipments according to future supply and demand. So it's almost an early version of today's commodity futures trading markets. It's quite amazing that it existed in those days with loads of traders just congregating around a train station. So that was their early life. So apart from pogroms, it was a comfortable life. But everything changed in 1914 when war broke out. And then my grandmother was probably about 12 years old at the start of the First World War. And although the battlefields were thousands of miles away from Pavlich, the war still had a profound effect on the town and on everybody who lived there. And the comfortable life that the family had led up to that point was shattered once and for all. So one of the first changes they would have noticed had a huge effect on Zeta's grain business. So this was how the train stations changed. After Germany declared war in 1914, the train station at Popilna changed from a stock exchange to an army embarkation point. Goods trains no longer brought news of grain prices from Kiev and Odessa, but transported military apparel to the distant front, and passenger services were replaced by troop carriers. Instead of throbbing with merchants and speculators, the train stations were drenched in the tears of mothers, wives and children, waving their beloved goodbye as they ran along the platform until it ended and they could run no further. Instead of talk of prices, foods and exchanges and bushels, all conversation was of mobilisation, detachments, regiments and ultimatums. My grandfather's routine was disrupted without his trips to the station. Although the scope of his business no longer required him to visit Popilna every day, he still undertook the journey to the train station once or twice a week. Now even this was denied him, and he began to pace around the house restlessly. He missed his outings and the social contact they provided, and he despaired of the murkiness that was settling over grain prices. The daily dealings at the train station had kept pricing transparent. Dealers knew how much was being paid for each product at every location. Now it was impossible to keep track. To make matters worse, inflation had started to increase, making it more important than ever to keep a close eye on the market. But exchange rates, tariffs and prices were all becoming harder and harder to gauge. They rose gradually at first and then faster and faster until they were running out of control like a downhill sleigh on an icy track. And all over Pavlich and elsewhere, families were obviously fearful of their menfolk being sent off to war. So some of my grandmother's old cousins had already managed to escape to Canada to avoid being called up by the military authorities. But once the war started, it was too late to escape. Oh, I'm going too far now. Go away, go away. There we are. But still, as historically, people had always tried to avoid conscription into the Russian army, and it was no different in 1914. So this was our family's experience. Thankfully, my father wasn't called up to fight in the first months of the war. As the menfolk of Pavlich marched off to the station to fill the never-ending lines of trains heading to the front, I prayed every night and every day that father wouldn't one day join them. He wasn't meant for fighting, this gentle, studious man who still dressed every day in his long black coat and skullcap. The first wave of recruits were green ticketers. My father hoped to be granted a blue ticket, which would mean he was allowed to study rather than go to war. Only the feeble-minded and the infirm were lucky enough to be granted a white ticket, which exempted them altogether, while those who failed the medical exams were red ticketers. I don't know if any of you have ever read the stories of Shaul Malechem, but he also talks about these white tickets and blue tickets and red tickets and everybody trying to avoid conscription. Pavlich was full of young men trying to make themselves ill by fasting, drinking salty water, or overindulging in salted herring to gain a red ticket. The rich took a different tack by bribing doctors or officials to reject their sons. Meanwhile, the mothers of one or two young men we knew ran themselves ragged going from one office to another through the warren of Russian officialdom, trying to approve that their last remaining boy should get the automatic exemption that applied to only sons. The official registers were notoriously inaccurate, and many hadn't been updated properly when people died or emigrated, but the process of verifying that a son was unavailable for service could cause weeks of frustration and distress. So, as I said, avoiding conscription was nothing new, and that was how a lot of our family ended up coming to Canada. So some managed to come just before the First World War, and it was a bit of a race against time for them, which were going to come first, their Canadian immigration papers, permits, or their call-up cards, and luckily they managed to get out before they were called up. Later in 1920, Nathan, who was then called Naftali, who's the little baby on the lap in this photo, he escaped conscription into the Red Army in 1920 after the Bolsheviks had taken over. He was called up to fight in Russia's, the new Soviet Red Army's campaign into Poland, where they were trying to spread world revolution. And that was the story that Izet Barbol, if you've read his stories, that he wrote about in his Red Cavalry stories. And it was a brutal campaign. And Nathan was such a timid yeshiva boy who dreamt of being a rabbi. And the thought of him going and fighting for the Red Army was pretty hard to imagine. So with World War One, for those left behind at home, life became harder as food and equipment got sent away to the distant front, and it left little to spare for those who were left behind at home. But thanks to Pearl's grandfather's grain business, at that time the family still had enough to eat. But in the cities, people were going hungry, and with insufficient fuels to light the fires, people were getting sick. And as the war dragged on year after year, the hardships increased for ordinary people left behind. In the major cities, this was really the huge cause of the unrest that prompted the revolutions of 1917. So 1917 began with the February Revolution, which was when the Tsar was overthrown. And then this was followed in October by the Bolshevik Revolution, when Lenin and the Bolsheviks seized power. So small towns like Pavlovich were fairly immune from the revolutionary fervour. But I've got a description of what was happening in Kiev, which was only about 100 kilometres away. And this was at the time of the February Revolution. The people talked openly, fearlessly in the streets about the end of the Tsar's reign. They talked about Russia withdrawing from the war and abandoning her allies, power to the workers, people's Soviets. Students handed out leaflets and waved red banners. What did it all mean? Would the war soon be over? Could the Tsar just resign? How can the workers take power? And what were the Soviets? To a 15-year-old girl in a small country town, the reports from the city were all very mysterious. But far away to the north, in Petrograd, as the Russian capital was now called, the demonstrations were coming to a head, and at last they culminated in the Tsar's abdication. It was as if a black cloud had lifted from above our heads. Alexander Kerensky and the provisional government filled the power void left by Tsar Nicholas and represented everything we'd ever hoped for. My sister Sarah came home from school early, rejoicing that she would no longer have to sing the national anthem. The hated God Save the Tsar was now banned. The Pale of Settlement was dissolved at a single blow. Censorship was abolished, and my grandfather began devouring newspapers and any other source of information he could find, hungry for news that had not previously been considered fit for public consumption. Kerensky has come and it's like a blessing, my grandfather would repeat again and again to anyone who would listen. No more Tsar, no more restrictions on Jewish jobs and residence permits. Now we have the same rights as everybody else in the country. I didn't understand the politics of it all, but I could feel the difference in my daily life. The mood of oppression that had settled over Pavlovich since the beginning of the war was suddenly lifted. People smiled, chatted, laughed. They talked about their hopes and dreams. They voiced aspirations that they'd never dared speak about before. Some even danced in the street. Zayda was more cheerful than he had been for years, and Baba's eyes sparkled in a way I'd hardly ever seen. We're free, my children, we're free, she laughed when she first heard the news, scurrying around the room, hugging each of her grandchildren in turn. So even though the revolution happened far away, it still had this hugely profound impact on people's lives. But unfortunately, Kerensky's leadership of the country was all too brief, and that was ended by the Bolshevik Revolution in October. And for ordinary people, the October Revolution just led to great uncertainty. Ukraine was a long, long way from Petrograd, where the revolution took place, and nobody really knew much about Lenin and his fellow revolutionaries, and certainly nobody could predict it that they and their heirs would stay in power for the next 70 years. But one of the first things that the Bolsheviks did do was to extricate Russian troops from the war, and this had a colossal effect on places like Pavlovich. Over the weeks that followed, the railways became a teeming mass of humanity. Not even Zayda would dare go to the train station now. His once daily haunt was heaving with unwashed bodies, many racked with disease and crawling with lice, as soldiers dribbled back home from distant lands, weak, thin and bedraggled like stray cats after a storm. From the window, I watched the slow, trudging progress through town of these grey bundles of bones, men who had once represented the Tsar's brave army. Baba was terrified lest these pitiful creatures, who looked too exhausted to lay a hand on anyone, rape her granddaughters, and she insisted that we stay indoors. But other townsfolk took pity on the returning troops, and they went out of their way to offer them soup and give them any old clothes or shoes that they could spare. Even after 3.5 years of wartime hardships, it was clear the privation that we had all suffered was nothing compared with the needs of the soldiers. But week after week, the ragged creatures kept on coming, more and more of them, until people began to worry that if they kept on giving their food and clothing away, they would have nothing left. And as the months passed, the reality dawned that the pale, unshaven men crisscrossing the countryside with guns couldn't all be soldiers returning to their homes after all. So who were these men? It eventually became clear that bands of armed thugs were roaming the land. It was impossible to tell who was who, but gradually all those generous souls in Pavlich who'd been welcoming the soldiers home with hot soup instead began hiding away their potatoes and winter boots, lest the men take them all. So although the Bolsheviks had pulled Russia out of the First World War, what they hadn't done was manage to deliver peace. So one of the first effects of the Bolshevik Revolution on places like Pavlich and certainly on our family was grain requisitioning. Once the Bolsheviks were in power, they started requisitioning grain. Ukraine was the breadbasket of Europe at that time. It was a huge grain-producing area. And they came, and not only did they requisition grain, but they also took the seed so that there was nothing to grow the harvest with for the following year. So this led to even more hardship and famine. And they came and raided the supplies of grain merchants like Pearl's grandfather. The Bolsheviks viewed merchants like my grandfather as class enemies. They also needed grain to feed their supporters in the cities, which were running out of food. Zayda knew that a knock at the door was inevitable, but when it came, he was still caught by surprise. My grandparents knew young Vanya well. He was Sasha the baker's son and lived down the road. They'd watched him grow up, from a wailing baby in his mother's arms, to a smart young schoolboy, and later a recruit in the Tsar's army. When he came to the house, Baba almost shrieked as she pulled open the door. She barely recognised him in the black leather coat that had reached down to his calves and the heavy leather boots. In his hand was a wooden truncheon. He was surrounded by a group of youths, all dressed identically to him, all talking loudly to one another. But Vanya was clearly their leader. Zayda hurried to the door, alerted by the commotion and the rush of cold air. "Vanya," he exclaimed, "what are you doing here, young man?" Vanya looked a little sheepish, perhaps embarrassed that his fellow Bolsheviks could see that he had associated with class enemies like my grandfather in the past. One of his Red Guards brushed Baba aside and headed towards the warehouse. "The Bolsheviks are in charge now, and we need to take your grain to feed the workers in the towns," the youth dictated as he stamped through the house. "But what about us? Who will feed us if you take our grain away?" Baba countered. "You bourgeois, you're all the same. The workers and peasants need bread if they're going to build socialism. Bread, land and freedom." Zayda just sat in his chair and watched as Vanya and his friends shoveled away the pyramids of grain until all that was left were a few thin scatterings of yellow spread across the grey stone floor, like dirt that had come in from the street and needed sweeping up. He knew he couldn't argue with them. He'd heard the news on the grapevine. Grain merchants all over Ukraine were having their stores ransacked. It was clear that from that day on, our lives would never be the same again. So from then on, all over Ukraine, and it's probably especially Ukraine, other parts of the Russian Empire too, but especially in Ukraine, the October Revolution just gave way to anarchy. So these newly formed bands of rebels and fighters were crisscrossing the land. Each group had a different allegiance. So some were fighting for nationalism, some for anarchism, some for Holy Russia, and sometimes it seemed just for the sake of fighting. And this was the start of the Russian Civil War. The Pavlich and the surrounding areas were the scene of many, many battles and many, many atrocities from 1918 to 1920. And I'm going to recount just one of many, many incidents that took place during that time. So this particular incident took place, it involved the White Army, which was the anti-Bolshevik force, under their Cossack leader, General Denikin. Almost all the groups, the Bolsheviks were the least anti-Semitic of the banda, as my grandmother called them, that were crisscrossing Russia at that time, and the White Army, especially under Denikin, and they were supported by the West. They were fiercely, fiercely anti-Bolshevik and fiercely, fiercely anti-Semitic. Five huge men burst in through the front door. They were clad in tatty greatcoats that reached almost to the floor. Grease pencil marks indicated their rank, outlining stars that had once been sewn onto their shoulder straps. Long, shining swords were tucked into their belts, and they carried rifles fixed with rusty bayonets. With their huge frames, they seemed to fill up the whole house. The tops of their heads almost touched the ceiling, and with each great stride, they squeezed my grandparents into the corners of the room where they cowered, shaking. The whites weren't like the anarchists who burst in and began smashing the furniture to pieces. They had brains and intuition that they used to figure out just where their victims might be hiding money or jewellery or hoarding food. The soldiers sniffed around like dogs, tapping at walls and floorboards, listening for a hollow echo that might indicate a hiding place. But they found nothing. Months before, my grandfather had taken everything of value and buried it in a big wooden chest in the field behind the house. "Money! Give us your money, old man," the first giant had demanded in Russian, prodding Zayda with his bayonet. Zayda's carefully learned Russian seemed to desert him, and he mumbled something incomprehensible, his eyes fixed on the scuffed leather boots of his interrogator. While his companions continued to search the house, kicking down the door to the warehouse, the leader of the group dealt my grandfather a swift blow with his rifle butt and watched poor Zayda crumple to the floor like a rag doll. Then he kicked him in the stomach with his huge leather boots until Zayda curled into a ball on the hard kitchen floor, as pitiful as a tiny child. Again and again he beat him with his gun and kicked him. By this time the other four soldiers had returned. Zayda wasn't a big man, so it didn't take them long to hustle him onto the table, pull his scuffed leather belt from around his waist, and force his head into the noose that they made with it. Then they hanged him from the hook on the kitchen ceiling that we used for drying meat. And when the soldiers left, the belt snapped and he fell to the floor and he survived. And my grandmother also told a story about how he used to beat his children with this leather belt. He'd given them a bit of a whip, especially over the Sabbath meal. It was the best time to kind of smack the children. And I like to think that it was those spankings with the leather belt that maybe weakened it a bit enough to that it broke and enabled him to survive. So by 1920, the Bolsheviks' grip on power in Ukraine had become stronger. These fightings and raids of the Civil War had died down, although they hadn't yet stopped altogether. But what followed, as a result of these grain requisitions, was great hunger and deprivation. And the Bolshevik government continued to requisition food supplies from the countryside. And even in the Ukraine, with its huge grain production, it was next to impossible to buy wheat or flour. And because they'd requisitioned the seed, this was just a vicious circle, and the famine went on for year after year. And the only bread you could buy at that time was on the black market, and I've got a lovely quote about black market bread. It's a very brief one. People said that flour made up only 5% of the loaf. The rest was a revolting blend of dried potato skins, mashed up soldiers' coats, or even dirt and mud from the road. It stuck to the roof of your mouth, and trying to cut it with a bread knife was a wasted effort. You needed a saw. Even so, if someone was unwise enough to go out in the street holding a piece of bread, children would steal it straight from their hands. So that's how desperate things had become by 1920. Thank you. as well as bread, sugar, potatoes, eggs, milk, all these things became unavailable, or if they were available, they were prohibitively expensive. And that's not to mention meat, which was just something that people no longer ate at all. And inflation was pushing up prices by the day. There reached the point where barter became the main means of doing business, and it became increasingly difficult for families to find enough food. And it was my grandmother who took on the role of finding food to feed her family. So she was not yet 20 years old. And we'll get a picture of her at this time. This is Pearl on the right here. No, it's not. This is Pearl standing. And these are her sisters, Ralph and Sarah. And you can tell by the clothes they're wearing. This picture is very different from the other pictures. They're going through a harder time. But Pearl's, at this stage, I think Sarah was away, her older sister Sarah was away, was at school, and her brother was at the yeshiva. And so there was the other two sisters, Pearl and Rachel, and the two cousins still in the house, and the grandparents. And the grandfather had been so weakened by his experience during the Civil War. He'd always been the family breadwinner, the successful one. That was all over. So Pearl, by this stage, 18, 19 years old, both her parents were dead, her grandparents were getting old and no longer had the strength to take on the role as family breadwinners. So to enable her grandparents and siblings and cousins to survive, Pearl started taking on terrifying, dangerous journeys by train to markets across the area. These markets were illegal, and if caught, the consequences for her would have been terrible. So my next reading will give a bit of an explanation of what she did to keep her family alive and ensure that they were ones who survived through this famine. It was still several years before regular train services were to resume. There were no timetables and no carriages for passengers. It wasn't possible to just buy a ticket and climb aboard. In fact, officially, ordinary people weren't allowed on board at all. Trains appeared whenever their cargoes of goods or troops were ready. This meant that sometimes they travelled through Popilna to Kiev or Odessa three times a day, and other times it was more like three times a week. Every so often they stopped at our station, but on many occasions they didn't. If the train didn't stop, I had to leap aboard while it was still moving and cling on for dear life until I had the chance to find a better spot. On a footplate between carriages, perched on top of a freight car, or crouching in the corner of an empty wagon. I learned how to leap into the doorway of a freight car, to aim for the gap between the wagons, or even if the train were travelling slowly enough, to crawl in between the wheels and work my way up to the carriage roof. The most terrifying part of the journey was arriving in Kiev. The station was the most awful place I'd ever encountered. It consisted of dozens of makeshift wooden huts that reeked of urine and crawled with rats and lice and all sorts of lowlife who'd found their way to the city. Refugees, smugglers, gypsies, deserters, the homeless, the destitute. Not only were traders at risk of being attacked and robbed, but officials were known to offer bribes to informers, and in return for a hunk of bread or a handful of rubles, any of these people could report me to the authorities for dealing in contraband goods, and then heaven knows where I would end up. So to avoid the risk, I threw myself off the train before reaching the station and gave the whole area a wide berth. Jumping off was much worse than boarding the train in the first place. At least in winter, deep drifts of snow lay either side of the train tracks, creating a soft bed to land in. But when spring arrived, the embankments were piled high with blackened slush, which towered above deep puddles that I had to try and avoid. And later in summer, when the ground was hard, I came home spotted with inky bruises where I'd hit the ground. And this was her life day in, day out, for about 3 years. But she would crisscross the countryside, buying, selling, bartering, whatever she could to feed the family, and sell back in Pavlich. And sometimes she would end up staying away from home overnight. On one memorable occasion, she got caught in a snowstorm and almost died in the cold. The sleigh driver had got lost, and they finally ended up in a village. They finally heard dogs barking, and that they were able to follow the noise and get to a village. And there was a Jewish lady who lived in the village, and you all know about Jewish hospitality and generosity. And this one Jewish lady in the village heard that there was a young Jewish girl who was among this group of market traders who got caught in the snowstorm. And she took her in, put her to bed, made her soup, warmed her up. And she ended up spending several days with this woman. And when she got back to Pavlich and went into her grandparents' house, they thought it was a ghost. They thought it was the ghost of their granddaughter because they'd given her up for dead. But being small, and she was a tiny, tiny woman. I'm 5'3" and I tower over her. She'd kind of be somewhere down here. Being so small, she was often able to listen in, to find little hiding places, and find places where she could eavesdrop on other people's conversations and find out the best places to go, where she could get certain things and what people wanted. And as a result of some of this kind of surreptitious ways of finding information, she would use this to her own advantage. And quite incredibly, she ended up becoming a black market gold dealer. And I'll tell you a bit about that. My grandparents collected coins, rings, medals, jewellery, any gold that family, friends or acquaintances still had. Young women gave earrings and bracelets that they'd been saving for their wedding trousseau. Mothers offered medals awarded to their dead sons for their bravery. Wives even gave up their wedding rings. All these goods were given to my grandparents on trust and hidden in secret compartments that Baba sewed into my tattered coat. I took the gold hundreds of miles away to Kharkov. The journey was murderous. Once I'd jumped off the train in Kiev, I had to work my way across to the other side of the jumble of stinking huts that made up the main station and leap aboard a train heading east. The trains were a different design from those travelling between Kiev and Odessa, and they offered no means of climbing onto the roof, nor even inside the carriages. Instead, I perched on the wooden boards that ran across the wheel axles. There was very little space. The icy wind whistled straight through me, and the noise of the wheels on the tracks was almost deafening. But these tiny platforms were in great demand. Hands clawed at me and clung to my arms as bagmen piled onto the boards and held onto whatever they could in a desperate attempt to stop themselves from falling off. Occasionally, with a sinister howl, the train would jerk and brake fiercely and somebody tumble from the platform. It would have been practically impossible not to fall under the wheels. Even if the train didn't stop, it took all day to reach Kharkov. More often it stopped repeatedly in the middle of nowhere, the endless miles of woodland revealing nothing of our location. But I never dared jump down to stretch my legs. It was too risky. There was no timetable to indicate when the train might move again. And besides, I was fearful of losing my precious spot above the wheels. If I gave it up, the other travellers might never let me back on board. At the end of each journey, I thanked God that I was still alive. Once in Kharkov, through a complex network of contacts, I was introduced to some shady dealers who asked me to follow them to the back of the market. I was almost shaking with nerves the first time I stepped behind the brick wall that separated me from the other market traders who might have offered some protection. The men were gruff but brisk, well-dressed if not well-mannered. They inspected my goods meticulously, then handed over hard currency in return. I hid the money away carefully in my secret pockets before stepping back into the marketplace. So she went to Kharkov with the gold and came back with the hard currency. It tended to be Polish currency that people wanted, because during the Civil War, each different party in the Civil War had printed their own money, and nobody really knew what was the right money, what the exchange rate was between them, which money was going to last, what was going to be reliable. So they wanted Polish money because they felt that was, it was safe, it was a hard currency. But the penalty would have been the same for her, whether she was caught with gold or whether she was caught with hard currency. The penalty was the same. She would have been shot. And my grandmother wasn't the only person travelling illegally on the trains. As I said at the beginning, you know, if this is where your family was from and you survived, that family survived, somebody in your family may have been doing similar things to try and make sure that your family was one of the ones that survived too. And finally, she couldn't take it anymore. And she, after 3 years of this, and she was living a life she hated this. She felt it was her duty to do this, to keep the rest of her family alive, to look after her grandparents who'd done so much for her and her siblings and cousins. But she could take it no more by 1924. And she had to escape. As you know, from the late 19th century onwards, there'd been a huge influx of immigrants from Russia to America and Canada. The first relatives of our family to leave Russia came to Canada around 1903 and settled in Winnipeg. And then subsequently, their family came over, the father and siblings of the first people to come over, came over to avoid, for the sons to avoid conscription to the First World War. And then Pearl was the next to come in 1924. So here she is in Winnipeg. I was amazed just how quickly Winnipeg came to feel like home. I was surrounded by familiar faces and not just those of my relatives. In the streets I recognised people I'd known in the past, in a life that was fast becoming a distant memory. Winnipeg was full of Pavlovichs. There was even a Pavlovich synagogue where almost every worshipper was familiar. Names and faces I had forgotten over the years came flooding back. How strange, I thought, that I hadn't noticed all these people disappear from my life over the last 20 years, and yet here they all were, carrying on just as they did back home, but halfway around the world. Even the weather in Winnipeg was familiar. People don't laugh if I say that in the UK. The warm summer months were followed by a brisk descent into winter. Although outside it was just as cold as during the worst Pavlovich snows, the houses were more sturdy and better insulated, and there was enough wood to light the fires in all the rooms. I'd forgotten what it was like not to feel a permanent chill throughout the long winter months. Even in the bleakest times, the stores remained well stocked. I thought back to the years of cold and hunger in Pavlovich and wondered how we'd all survived. And for my trading trips across the country, they seemed like a nightmare from another lifetime entirely. So over the course of the next year or so, she raised enough money to bring the rest of her family over to join her there. And sadly, her grandfather died in the intervening period. And this was terribly sad because although her grandfather had been quite a fierce man and whipped his grandchildren with his leather belt, my grandmother was devoted to him. And she said that when she left for Canada, he gave me his last pennies for the journey, and he gave me his soul. And it was a tragedy that she never saw him again. But here's Bubba Pessy in the middle, surrounded by her children in Winnipeg. So there we are. So this is Pearl and her husband Itzik, who you knew as Uncle Izzy, who became Isidore Cooper, and Nathan, Sarah, and Rachel, and their cousin Morris, who all came over to Canada. Only one of the six siblings that lived together with them, with their grandparents in Russia, didn't come over. That was Morris's older sister, Baya. She was studying by then in Kiev and chose to stay. She was going to get married. She did get married. She remained in Kiev. And in 1941, when the Nazis invaded, she was put on a ship on the River Dnieper, and the ship was set alight, and there were no survivors. And I believe my grandmother had a framed photo of her in her apartment till the end. So my story finishes, I don't really go into her life in Canada, but my story finishes when Pearl and Itzik get married in 1926, and almost 9 months later, my aunt, their first child. No, I don't mean almost in that moment. What I meant was around 9 months later, not almost 9 months later. their first child, my aunt Lil, who was known as Leah at the time, after her grandmother was born. So I think I'm more or less out of time. So we'll probably open up for questions now. And I can talk a little bit about how the book came about, and I mean, I've talked a little bit about how the recordings came about, so how I discovered about these stories. But if anyone's got any questions, hello.
How did the family survive once Pearl came to Canada? How did they live?
Well, I mean, that was what she was terrified about. And, you know, she kept saying, I can't go, I can't leave you all, because what will you do? And her grandparents kept saying, God will provide. Just go, you've done enough now, God will provide. And I think sometimes her younger sister, Rachel, sometimes her cousin, Morris, would go with her on her trading trips. And I think they didn't really have that same sense of urgency and the need to prove themselves. But they were able to do a bit of what Pearl did, and things were easing up then. The famine was easing off, and things were getting easier by that point anyway. So they managed to survive. Hello.
At the beginning, when you were talking about the diversity in the shtetl,
yes,
different languages, different religions, you referred to it as a melting pot.
Yes.
And I never think of shtetls as melting
pots. No, do you think of them as being very divided or purely Jewish?
No. Different groups living.
Well,
it's socializing.
No, but that's interesting. Yeah. Certainly in Pavlovich, that was the experience they had. She talked enormously warmly about lots of their Ukrainian and Polish friends during the Civil War, when you had these anti-Semitic banda coming through. They were sheltered over and over and over again by different Ukrainian friends, by people who worked for them, who helped Baba with tasks around the house, whatever. I mean, they went to put themselves at enormous risk to harbour people. There was another family, the Zhukov family, who were neighbours. I mean, it sounds like, you know, there was a Jewish quarter and an Orthodox quarter. I think there was a Catholic quarter. There was an Armenian quarter, which I find a bit strange as well. But although there was that, there was also, you know, they weren't clearly defined lines. These things did overlap. And so our family lived either next door or very close to the Zhukov family, who were Ukrainian butchers, and they slaughtered pigs. But the two families were very close, and they did them all kinds of favours. So I think, whether it's a myth or whether Pavlovich was unusual, I don't know. But certainly they had very close companionship with Ukrainians and with other with Polish people.
Hi. It's very great for me to hear this. My mother comes from Pavlovich in Winnipeg, and she has a mixture of stories. And as far as people together, she did play the mandolin in a mandolin orchestra when she was a little kid, and the Tsar listened to them for a few minutes.
Wow.
But in about 1914, her brother, who was married and was born in 1900, was sent to Palestine so he wouldn't be conscripted.
Right, yeah. I mean, the book is full of almost every generation of men in the book. There was a story of something. So their great, my Pearl's great-grandfather, who also lived with them for a time, when he was young, conscription was for 25 years into the Russian army. And they were not allowed to be Jewish. They conscripted a huge number of Jewish boys. They had a large quota to fill of Jews, basically not because Jews were good fighters, but because the Tsar wanted to reduce the number of Jews in his empire. So he's got the Jews into the army, and basically they weren't allowed to follow the kosher laws. They had to march on the Sabbath. They weren't allowed to retain their faith. Some of them they would be forced to kneel and not be given any food and drink until they agreed to convert to Orthodox Christianity, and some took their own lives to not to do that. But it really was like the Jewishness was squeezed out of them like water from a sponge. And it was a policy, you know, it wasn't just one nasty recruiting officer or whatever doing that. It was official policy.
Yeah. I don't know if I missed it, but you did say something about the recordings were in Yiddish. You don't speak Yiddish.
Yes.
How did you get them translated?
Oh, my father translated them. So my dad grew up speaking Yiddish. So we listened to them together and he translated them.
Where can we buy the book?
You can buy it from me today. So I've got some copies that I can sell, and I'll go and sit over here, and you can buy copies from me. It's available on Amazon. If you go to your local bookseller, they should be able to order it in for you as well.
What was said about education for the kids, learning to read or write, or...?
Well, they started off going to Jewish school, going for Cheder, and... pretty much all the Jewish kids in the shtetl went. And then Sarah, Pearl's older sister, she was very bright, and she ended up going to the Russian school. But there were quotas for Jewish children being able to get into Russian school. So you had to be either very bright or very lucky to get in. But she was lucky enough to get into the Russian school. Her brother Nathan, once he was old enough, went to yeshiva. But Pearl started off going to a school after Heijon. She basically dropped out, didn't like it. Her grandparents got her a tutor for a short time, and I think that fell through. And education for girls wasn't considered particularly important. I don't know about Rachel. I don't know if you two know if she was educated or not. But my grandmother grew up, she could write Yiddish using the Hebrew alphabet, even after 50 years in Canada and America. She ended up moving to California. She could never write, she never learned to write English properly. And she would send us cards for Hanukkah and for our birthdays. And sometimes these things would take months to arrive because she never managed to write the address down properly. And these things would go to... we lived in a city called Norwich. I think there's a Norwich in somewhere in the east coast of America, Connecticut or something. Yeah. So these letters would have gone to Connecticut, California to Connecticut, and months later they finally find their way to England.
What's your take on you've got a book here on your grandmother's stories. What do you think she would think about all of this?
Ah. Well, I know. I mean, it's something I do worry about. You know, when I was writing, I was kind of thinking of it selfishly. You know, this is such a wonderful story. I want to be a writer and tell this story. And it was only later that I did think, what would Grandma have thought? Because she was long gone by then. And I really hope that she'd have been proud of me for writing it, and proud of herself for being the heroine of this story, really. I don't know, I mean, you, as Pearl's nieces who knew her better than me, I don't know if you have a sense of whether she would have liked the story, whether she'd have been embarrassed by it or horrified by it. I hope she would have loved it.
You presented so well, and you've done so much research and a lot into it. No, she would have been very proud. She would have had, you know, a way of trying to, you know, be top boss.
I'm sure she would have told me, I've got loads of things wrong. I've made so many mistakes. Sorry.
What was the size of the Jewish community there? And did you ever try to get some records
The question, if you didn't hear it, was what was the size of the Jewish community, and did I try to get some records from the place? So it was a town of, I think about a third of the residents were Jewish. I think there were about 3,000 Jews in Pavelich, and that was about a third of the community. My dad and I travelled to Pavelich together in 2005 when I was researching the book, and most of the town was destroyed during the Nazi occupation. One of the old synagogues survived, and it's been turned into a small museum of the town. So the records, I mean, we repeatedly asked if there were records, and we were just told there was a war here, the Nazis destroyed everything, everything got lost at that period. But the little museum documents the town with, you know, quite a lot of information about the Jewish community. So there's some information there. How did it come about that her memories were recorded? Well, this was, I don't know if you were here at the beginning when I first started speaking, but she, my father recorded her. And he was a historian, and he wanted to go back to these stories from as a scholar, as an academic, and go back, and he did a lot of research on the period himself as well. So he went to California with these audio tapes and recorded her telling her stories. Yeah.
I probably should know the answer to this, but was it because Winnipeg reminded people a lot of Ukraine that they chose Winnipeg?
I'm not sure anyone actually chose Winnipeg.
There were for agricultural purposes.
Yeah, the land. Yeah, I mean, so it was more a case of. You know, that part of Canada was being settled, and they were inviting people to come and buy land. But Jews historically were never allowed to own land in the Russian Empire. They weren't farmers; they didn't know how to farm. So they came to the cities, and then one person
there
was
there. Jewish agricultural colonies.
And then right? Yes, there were. Yes. Yeah.
The Lipton colony, Montefiore colony. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The trains were not allowed to stop from eastern Canada to Winnipeg.
Right.
This is why. And some people had heard about the climate in Winnipeg. And this is why around St. Catharines, there was a Jewish community that arose where the train slowed down for supplies. And people jumped off.
That's fascinating. I haven't heard that before. That's really interesting. Any more questions? So if there's no more questions, I'm going to sit over there. I've got books available for sale tonight. So the book normally retails for $25 on Amazon. I can sell it tonight at a bit of a discount. I can give it to you for $25 Canadian, and I'll sign copies for you. And thank you so much for coming.
On your behalf, I would just like to thank Lisa and thank the family for having a bar mitzvah so that she could be here this evening. My family left Ukraine in 1923, so also from not far from Kiev. So a lot of the stories certainly resonate with me. I feel this book fills a tremendous void.
Yeah.
In telling the stories. I don't know if there are other books like this.
Very few.
But it really is an important aspect of Jewish genealogy. I mean, the period we're talking about, 120 years ago, 130 years ago, some words come to mind. One is resilience of the people to survive. The need to be creative, and how they lived just one day at a time, not thinking too much into the future. It was really a question of survival, and I think your book clearly shows how they did it, and really very interesting to read. So on behalf of us all, thank you very much.